Temporal discussion is recorded in front of live goblins.
Making your mark in the cavern's dark takes everything you've got. Taking a break from being summoned sure would help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you wanna go where no one knows your calling name. Or the burden of your fame. You wanna see some, find some peace, just till you miss the acclaim. You wanna be where no one knows your calling name. Blundering teams and low-bid schemes need to escape the shame. You wanna be where no one knows the greater game. All of those quests where you get no rest because you made a pact. You're a bracelet up, but two spells down, cause they said malefact. And your daughter's trapped somewhere again. Be glad there's one place in the world where no one knows the greater game. And your year of orange shame. Blundering teams and lawless schemes need to escape the shame. You wanna be where no one knows the greater game. You wanna go where no one knows your calling name. You wanna be where no one knows the greater game.
Welcome, listeners of Illusion to Temporal Discussion, the episode-by-episode Nightmare Retrospective Podcast. I'm Martin Harder, and I haven't thought of anything to put here.
This is a professional podcast, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Martin O'Doney, and I'm not from St. Albans, which probably explains everything. I did have an uncle who lived in St. Albans, mind. He was a neighbour of Edwina Currie at the height of the Salmonella poisoning scare, which definitely explains everything.
Today we're looking at Series 4, Episode 7. The episode originally aired on Friday, October the 12th, 1990. Maria McKee remained at number one with Show Me Heaven, and Disney's The Little Mermaid continued to dominate at the box office.
Temporal Discussion. Temporal Discussion. Bringing you the latest news from 1990.
Central banks' restrictive monetary policies and a decline in consumer confidence ultimately contributed to a recession that was just starting to spread across most of the Western world.
Mm-hmm. Classic thing with UK politicians. We will always have a Chancellor of the Exchequer who claims credit when the economy is going well, but there's always someone else to blame when it all goes boobs up. A few years before this, while Nigel Lawson was Chancellor, we had this Lawson boom where there was a actually pretty, in hindsight, pretty unremarkable burst of high growth for a couple of years. By 1990, we were back in recession, and John Major was the Chancellor at this point, and he was blaming it on the recession in America. But it does appear that he did have a point there, at least.
The effects of the recession played a role in Bill Clinton's victory against George H.W. Bush in 1992's US presidential election. Along with Brian Mulroney's resignation as Prime Minister of Canada, 15% fewer active businesses, unemployment as high as 20% in Finland, civil unrest in the UK, and the expansion of bargain retailers in the US and abroad were all effects of the recession.
There are two approaches to a government trying to sort of stimulate the economy and combat inflation. One is the fiscal approach, where government money is basically invested directly into industry. And the other is sometimes called monetarist, although it's actually not the same as monetarism, where they fiddle with interest rates instead. So the idea is if you've got lower interest rates, people aren't going to get a big reward for saving up. So they'll spend the money, and that will cause more activity in the economy. Also, they're more likely to borrow money if the interest rates low, so they can spend that as well. If inflation starts to get out of control, that means there's too much stimulus and you need to slow it down. So you raise interest rates, the idea is, and that will make borrowing expensive, so people will try and pay off their loans more quickly rather than buying stuff. And they'll also save more, hopefully, because they're getting a better interest rate on it. The 80s was sort of the transition decade between the two approaches. The Thatcher government tried outright monetarism at the beginning of the 1980s, and it caused a massive unemployment disaster. And so they very quickly abandoned the all-out monetarism. But they did stick with the monetarist approach to interest rates rather than investing directly in the economy. I'd say the civil unrest in the UK is a bit overstated here. It was far, far higher in earlier years than it was at the turn of the 90s. There were the poll tax riots in 1990, but that was the only big manifestation of civil unrest at that time, I would have said.
And now time turns. The recording light burns. Time out is gone. The podcast is on.
Greetings. Dare to watch what others dare to do? Good. Then we've a treat in store for you. Pickle, the challengers, who are they and how are they faring?
We begin proceedings with Pickle reminding us who we're watching. The team consists of advisors Karina, Emma, scary bank fraud advert lady Catherine.
Did you see what I did there?
And Dungeoneer Nikki.
They're 22 minutes into their quest for the crown, but still in level one. They're from St. Albans. If that explains anything.
They've looked okay, a bit slow in 22 minutes and they've not actually found a well way yet.
I don't think we can really blame the team for that, though.
No, not really, no. I'm going to say it now because I'm going to be saying it again later in the episode. It is one of the worst ever to watch this.
Completely agree. We're going to do the best we can, but this is such a boring episode.
It is. It genuinely is. We know we're supposed to love Nightmare. We do. But the thing about loving something is you tell it when it's got it wrong.
Let's just skip this episode. Let's just go watch The Good Life instead.
Treacle Kendall and Richard sugar-flavoured snob briars. What do they do now? Chocolate bloody butternuts, that's what. They're nothing but a couple of reactionary stereotypes confirming the myth that everyone in Britain is a lovable middle-class eccentric, and I hate them.
Well, you can just shut up, Vivian. You can just about blooming well shut up. Because if you've got anything horrid to say about Felicity Kendall, you can just about blummin' well say it to me first, all right?
Rick, I just did.
Traeger makes one of the most empty speculations about the team I've ever heard here.
Perhaps this time the dungeon has met its match.
I genuinely reckon it was just something that was recorded and they could slot it into any episode.
I think it was an outtake from one of the dungeoneers who got into level three, and they thought that episode was going to start around there because it just does not flow at all from where we are. This team hasn't even found the first wellway yet. Why speculate on whether the dungeons met the match with this one particularly? At least let them get a little way to level two before you say something like that.
Game on!
I want to grow.
You want to grow? Oh.
When we last saw Nikki, she had just utilized the contents of a bottle marked small to get through a tiny door. She's now emerged in the next chamber through a door in a bricked-up fireplace. Motley is here, leaning on the mantelpiece and looking down at the vertically challenged adventurer. Nikki tells him that she wants to grow, and Motley just happens to have something that might help.
How fortunate! I always get the feeling sometimes that someone's written this and it isn't really true.
What I've got here, and goodness knows if it's going to work, is a bit of stuff that Merlin left lying around in his study. Now, he calls it Grow Me Quick. And I always reckoned it was some sort of fertilizer. So if you end up smelling a bit ripe, don't blame me, all right? Yeah. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Here we go then.
Right, the dust is about to fall on you and you're growing now, Nikki. Right, you're about normal size.
Yeah! How you've grown!
Motley throws some white powder over Nikki's head. It was just coming out of the 80s.
Here we go. This is. I want this on record again here, everybody. He said that one, not me.
So the powder briefly becomes an unconvincing cartoon cloud before turning into even a less convincing magical star effect. And Nikki begins to grow.
Even by the standards of 1990, this is very flat. It's not even defined graphics, is it? It just looks like there's a bit of damage on your TV screen.
The actual growing effect doesn't look too bad.
Well, yeah, but that's a technique that television had mastered about 15 years earlier. didn't they?
So I reckon they did this by filming Motley separately.
That is very, very obvious split screen work, given the way that while Nikki is growing, Motley is gazing in open-mouthed astonishment at something that appears to be happening about 3 inches above her head.
Oh, dear. And about time. Because I've just seen the dungeon cat sneaking about in one of the corridors. One sniff of you and you be kippers. Anyway, I've got to go. Because Motley's on call for a bit of the old dance and comedy, know what I mean? Well, some of us professionals have got to work. Anyway, my friend, mind how you grow.
Can I just murder Motley a little bit? Just a little bit. I just make him slightly dead, please. Just a little bit. Just for that joke, please.
Okay, the Joker's now left the room.
Trigger tells Nikki to hold up the eye shield as she leaves the room.
The scene... it's an uninteresting room, but at least it's a new one, which is has to immediately get it a point in season 4. And the scenario is very Alice in Wonderland derived. But again, at least it's something different. I actually do welcome the scene, even though it's not particularly interesting or particularly well realised, because at least it's something new.
We can see through the eye shield now.
Where am I?
You're in a dark room, and in front of you there is a sort of well with something on it. There are 2 steps. I'll guide you towards it to see what's there.
Oh, thank heavens. I was starting to wonder if they'd ever find the well way. Level 2 beckons. So Nikki knapsacks the bread that is lying on the steps of the well, bringing her life force back to green. And then the team start differing a little at exactly the moment when there is literally only one real option in front of them. So Catherine tells Nikki to climb the steps and get into the well. It's not exactly drama, this, is it? Even though you've got a ghost suddenly closing in quite rapidly. All of the conviction of this scene is actually coming from Hugo's input to it, isn't it? Nikki in particular needs to loosen up a little bit, but I think all of them just need to wake up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for staying calm when there's a threat, but that's ridiculous.
You can apply urgency while still being calm. One of the things they had in the first 3 seasons was they had more than one well chamber, so you could change them around. But all the wells seem to be in the same chamber in season 4.
Where am I?
You're in a room with windows and standing on a table.
Yeah.
Can you get down off the table, please? There's also somebody in the room.
Danger, that's a goblin hunting horn.
Quick! Save me from the goblin! Save me, quickly!
Nikki drops into level 2 and arrives, wouldn't you know, it's in the stocks chamber.
And we'd like to point out that it is stocks, not pillory here.
It is. For the first time in a while, the term stocks is actually being applied correctly. I don't know if they just decided to use the stocks simply because the teams were all saying stocks. So they thought, oh, well, we might as well make them accurate retrospectively. I can understand why they'd rather use the pillory, because manoeuvring the thing to get it into the blue screen room would probably be a lot easier with the pillory, given how heavy the stocks are. Melisandre is in the stocks, and the goblin hunting horn sounds, so the team, for some reason, don't need any encouragement to free the maiden. Melisandre, once she's free, leads Nikki out of the room through one of the passive paths, which is highlighted by the eye shield. Zoe Lofton left after this season. It might have been for a number of reasons, but if it was just she got irritated, I don't think I can entirely blame her, because the material she's given in this season was horrible.
Well, I'd have left her there. Stupid maid shouldn't get in that sort of muddle.
Come now, Pickle, where's your humanity? Oh, sorry, I forgot. Never mind, Nick is human enough, which is just as well for Melly.
Oh, well, thanks a trillion. That was really very kind of you. I'm Melisandre, by the way. What are you called?
Nikki.
Oh, the ghastly little beast, Nikki. Don't let them get me.
Nikki and Melly are in the level 2 clue room now, which is as bland and nondescript as ever for this series. Before they can investigate the items, though, the goblins appear. Melly essentially uses Nikki as a human shield as she drags her to the rear of the chamber.
Don't let them get me, she squeaks. She is a stereotyped Doctor Who companion from the 60s. I'm watching this and seeing Nikki basically letting her hide behind there. And I'm thinking, I'm reminded of the great Niemöller poem where they say, first they came for the Jews and I did nothing. But I adjust it for Nightmare here. And it says, first they came for Melisandre. And I said, here she is, help yourself and bon appetit. Melisandre just got released from the stocks by Nikki. In all probability, the goblins would have eaten her if Nikki hadn't done that. And what does Melisandre do in the next room? She hides behind Nikki.
I don't have the distaste for Melisandre you do, but that, yeah, that is ridiculous.
Season 4 Melisandre, I'm saying here, you know, since to some extent, season four Motley. I detest both of them so much in this particular season. Mm. They become such time-wasting dipsticks. They're getting in the way of quests most of the time. All right, Motley had the solution for the small thing at the beginning of the episode, but neither of them are actually doing anything positive anymore. I didn't really like Melly very much in the third season, but she was far more likable then than this. Here she's just a cowardly wimp. She's Scooter from Challenge of the GoBots. You know? That's how bad she is. You want her to get eaten by the goblins.
Fortunately for the both of them, though, another dungeon character is close at hand.
Oh, what? Come on, scum bothering humans, are you? Come on, I'm sure you'd much rather dance with some water.
This is one of the most wasted moments in Nightmare, because it pretty much amounts to nothing.
Partly that, partly also, it underlines there's absolutely no point in Melisandre tagging along. But that actually gets worse in the following scene. I mean, really seriously bad stuff in the following scene. There is something slightly comical about the way, is it Karina, the advisor on the far left, I think she's called. She tries to summarise what just happened for Nikki's benefit, and then she just sort of give up trying about halfway through. On the plus side, I do rather enjoy Gundrada's blood-curdling description of cutting goblins in half, and each of the pieces being bigger than the goblins she just scared off. I quite like that bit. I also rather enjoy the way she clearly has nothing but contempt for Melisandre. I'm definitely on Gundrada's side at the moment. But yeah, this whole thing is pointless. Gundrada is there and then she goes. You know, as soon as they go through the next door, she suddenly disappeared. And then Melisandre's about to leave as well, having contributed absolutely nothing. And in fact, she's about to take something away. Anyway, we'll get there when we get there.
Gundrada advises that the goblins have probably gone for reinforcements and may even return with a hobgoblin, so they should choose their objects fast.
I would say I'd like it if a hobgoblin did show up around here about this point. In fact, I'd like a hobgoblin to appear there regularly, because it would make the clue room interesting again. Nothing good happens in the clue room in this season. You remember in season two and season three, we were always expressing our love for the level two clue room then. Some of the really classic scenes happened there. The first appearance of Hordris, the first appearance of Mogdred. Really interesting stuff used to happen in the level two clue room. This one, all the worst scenes seem to happen in it. Remember the Adore spell on the previous quest? That happened in there!
Even the Adore spell was preferable to this. At least something was happening there.
Something stupid and embarrassing, but at least something was happening. Gundrada grabs a necklace from the table, claiming she saw it first. How did she know that? I can't imagine. And she keeps watch while Nikki chooses objects from the ones remaining. Some ham, which gets knacked with Melly's help. A bar of silver, a length of rope, and an hourglass, or sand timer as they call it. They choose to take the silver bar and the rope. This whole business really honks me off. I should go into full detail in the next room, but for now, let me just say that the level two clue room has turned into a joke. And this is one of the worst bits here. I'll explain why in a second. It's because of the rope.
I think I know where you're coming from.
The goblins return and Gundrada chases them off while Melly leads Nikki out.
Take the silver bar and the rope.
Yes, that's good.
Okay, you're going through a room. We can see through the eye shield again, Nikki. There's...
Oh, wow!
In the castle.
Oh, it's a pity that Gundrada's gone. She seemed a rather useful type to have around. Oh, dear. I don't know how to ask this, Nikki, but I could get back into level one if only I had that rope. Now, I know you need it as well, but if I don't get out of level two, the goblins are going to come and get me.
The pair find themselves in this courtyard, but they'd obviously been in a couple of screens earlier for the well chamber. But there's no well here now, just an exit in the far left. Team suggests that Nikki offers some kind of exchange of Melisandre for the rope, but Melly doesn't have anything. They decide to give her the rope anyway, and Melisandre then, doesn't even guide her out, really. This scene infuriates me as much as any I have ever seen in Nightmare, and it really sums up how Melisandre is just an annoyance and an obstacle. Why didn't Melisandre claim the rope back in the clue room if she wants it? Then Nikki could have at least taken the hourglass. At least she'd still have had two clue objects. Instead, Melly just stands around with her hand behind her back, saying and doing nothing and taking nothing. Then she gets to here and then scavs one of the objects Nikki's taken off of her afterwards. What was the point of that? What was the point of her even appearing in the quest? Nikki has gained nothing and actually lost something by rescuing Melisandre from the stocks. Now Melly says, oh, I'll keep watch of the goblins for you as a thank you. And do what exactly if they show up? She keeps screaming and hiding behind everyone else when she sees goblins arriving. What use will she be this time if more of them show up? Let the goblins have her, Nikki. It really, really honks me off, that scene. It really does.
I do love it when you go off on a comedian rant like that.
It must make good radio. But oh, it just makes me so angry. It's so badly written. I don't know if Tim Child was just scratching for ideas at the moment or just writing any old rubbish. I mean, it is rubbish. It just seems to be a way of using up clue objects without having to come up with an actual use for them.
Can I have the rope or not, Nikki?
Should I give her the rope?
Yes. Oh, thank you. Oh, the least I can do is watch for goblins while you get a good safe distance ahead.
Okay. Now, don't you worry about me. I'm older than I look, you know.
Which is strange, because I never seem to get any older.
Tragically, it looks like Melisandre survives, but Nikki leaves her behind, thank goodness.
You can see through the eye shield again, Nikki. Right, walk up the steps, please. Where am I?
You're in a room, Nikki. In front of you, there are two doors, one on the left and one on the right. On the floor, there's just a stone pattern.
Warning, team, everything here is unstable. Proceed with care, but don't delay.
Hurry up.
Nikki, walk forward.
Quick, hurry up.
I can't decide if Hugo fluffed his line here or not. Because every other time that he has this line, he says, nothing here is stable. Whereas here he said, everything here is unstable. So was he just trying to break it up a little bit?
I suspect Hugo just changed it deliberately because he was desperate for something slightly different to say. he probably sensed that the watchers were getting as desperate as he was by this point. Mm. And he thought, right, okay, I'll just change the line so at least it sounds different. Just anything to get away from the uniformity of season four.
For the first time in ages, this is a chamber where something's actually happening.
You could argue this is the first time on all of level two where something is actually happening.
Probably the first time in the episode. But the problem I have here, and it's a bit of an unusual problem to have, is that the team are too good at it. They just do it.
They actually handle it quite impressively, don't they?
They do. But it makes it boring as well.
It doesn't allow the tension to build up. This broader point we're making, though, about not much happening until we get to this point where they actually hit a floor puzzle, which is dangerous to them. This is one of my long-standing points about Nightmare, going back a long time. I've been arguing this for well over 25 years now. After the first three seasons, the floor puzzles become scarcer and a lot of the locations become more real and therefore are less likely to contain actual dangers unless you do a lot of serious modifications to the photographs. It does speed up the series a little, although it takes a couple of years to actually even have that effect, but it becomes less consistently exciting because there's no longer a threat at every turn. It does make room for more non-player character depth, which definitely comes across from season five onwards with Lord Fear and the forces of the opposition. I would say they're more rounded characters than the early characters. And you get more detailed plot development, which, depending on what you're looking for, can be considered a big plus as well. But it can really test your patience when the gameplay gets so passive and long stretches of quests from season four onwards have little perceivable threat in them, apart from stray goblins suddenly sent onto the screen to hurry things up, or maybe a ghost haunting. So the game is altering, and in ways that do actually make it fundamentally different from what it was at the beginning.
Take sidestep to your right.
Quick,
please. Quick. Stop, walk forward.
To the team's credits, they deal with the block and tackle calmly and efficiently into a brisk walk forward and a few sidesteps to the right. Nikki is through the right-hand door and onto the next chamber. So, as you say, the tension never really happened.
Take sidestep to your right again and walk forward.
Where am I?
Nikki, you're in a quite big room with a door to your right. There is some objects in the room.
There's a man.
With some man.
Yeah. In a stock.
Pity a poor prisoner! Help me!
What for?
Help me!
Oh no, the quest is now recycling material from itself. It's not even bothering with the previous quest. We're in Stocks Room 2, and it's the Stocks. Again, it's not even the pillory, it's the Stocks again. Nikki finds herself in another nondescript room, which is true of most of season four, This one has a few bones scattered around, so probably just to try and make it look a bit spookier. There is a pillory here as well, which seems to be implying there's a dead body that's fallen to bits there and rotted away. But the stocks are there as well, and there's an old man trapped inside it. This is a complete rehash of an identical scene in Team One's quest. And we know, even before we hear the old man's voice, that it's Merlin. When we hear his voice, it's definitely Merlin. But it's not clear whether the team have actually figured this out yet.
Literally just repeating, like, no, yeah, if it had been in the previous level, maybe.
Yeah, it's not even that.
It was like two or three chambers ago.
Yeah, the show has hit one of the most boring troughs in its history at this point. And it speaks of a dreadful lack of thought or imagination. When writing this, the writer actually deliberately had the same scenario from a few rooms away on the same level. It was actually in the same script when they wrote it. Why not at least swap the pillory with the stocks just to vary things up slightly? It's just inexcusable.
The team debate investigating the rest of their surroundings first, but eventually decide to take mercy on the old man and let him out.
Oh, bless you. Oh, can you come over here, my dear? Oh, thank you. Thank you, Nicky. It really can get quite uncomfortable in those things, I can see.
Merlin tells her that she'll need magic to proceed, which he will give her if she can answer his riddle. Cold as death and slow heartbeat, hunger dies in winter's sleep. What is it?
You die. Winter dies. Could be something that hibernates. Cold as death.
Very easy.
Nicky, have you any idea?
No.
Their answer is water after a lot of conferring.
After a lot of conferring and one of them actually saying the correct answer.
Yes.
And getting vetoed.
Yes. And that's sad.
The advisor Karina did initially say hibernation, but was just completely ignored.
As soon as they say winter sleep, that's all you really need, isn't it? I just don't see any connection with water at all.
No. So hibernating animals actually do lower their body temperature by around 5 to 10 degrees Celsius. And should they drop below this temperature, they utilize their body's stores of brown fat. So just as a quick explanation, ordinary fat is white. And when it is consumed, it breaks down through intermediary processes to fuel shivering, which in turn produces body heat when the muscles are work. But brown fat possesses a unique protein that enables it to cut out the middleman, so to speak. The power stations of cells, the mitochondria, have the ability to directly oxidize brown fat. Without any additional stages or shivering, the chemical reaction produces heat directly. The non-shivering thermogenesis is the scientific term for the process, none of which is particularly helpful to Nicky and the team, though, as they venture meekly onwards.
I can recall when it was first broadcast, my mum was watching it with me and my brother. She was normally confused by the wording of Nightmare Riddles, but even she got this one straight away. Losing status now, almost certainly.
We are getting to a point of this quest that I genuinely quite like.
Okay.
Hibernation was the truth I sought.
What a pity.
I can't give you any magic, I'm afraid, but the way lies that way. Be off with you.
Nicky, keep walking forwards. Nicky, you're in a room. There seems to be gaps to either side of you. And
Stop!
A drawbridge going across.
I think this must be another door monster, Master.
Yes.
Time for the calling, I think.
But do they remember the right words? So much to remember and such a short time to do it in.
The team instruct Nicky to recite the calling.
True and false, false and true, open up and let us through.
I do rather like the obvious movable CGI ceiling that's been added above the drawbridge here. That establishes a new threat of kind.
The face of Dorcas appears, and we get the usual spiel about weariness and despair before she poses her questions to Nicky and the team.
Is Dorcas a she or a he?
I'm not sure.
I thought it was always a pun on Dorcas, which would make him male. And it is played by Michael Kiel. I remember in season 2, Traegard says, I've never been too sure what sex they are about war monsters. Why should it be any different with doors?
The first word in most dictionaries is aardvark. Oh, true or false?
Aardvark! Can't you see that, Your Highness? It's a bloody aardvark!
So there is much discussion here, including whether she said first word or first bird.
False, they suggest. False!
And I take issue with this.
You take issue with it, Mr. H. Go on, take issue with it. You show him, Mr. H.
I think this is unfair. Although aardvark is commonly believed to be the first word in most dictionaries, it's actually a, which the Oxford English Dictionary describes as used when referring to someone or something for the first time in a text or conversation, and used to indicate membership of a class of people or things.
That is certainly true today, to the best of my knowledge. I'm not sure if it was back in 1990. We can take it as
a reliable... Well, it should have been.
Yes, it probably should have been. We have to take into account the factual accuracy and reliability of that great 1980s historical documentary, Blackadder the Third.
It's a bloody aardvark!
Sausage! Sausage!
Last Jedi's. Technically speaking, the correct definition of A is the indefinite article indicating a specimen of object not previously referred to. The definite article is, of course, the. I do actually find the first bird business accidentally hilarious, entertaining for the wrong reasons, an aardvark with wings.
In nature, the polar bear and the penguin never meet. True or false?
They initially say false, but then they change it to true.
They give the correct reason why, though. Do you remember in the mid-1980s, there was a quiz show on at dinner times just after Children's BBC ended for the day called Master Team? It was hosted by Angela Rippon. It was actually very popular. I had a really, really good theme tune, did Master Team. So, see if you can find it on YouTube. I remember on that, they wanted a very similar question. It says, how do penguins protect themselves from polar bears in the wild? And the guy being questioned actually worked for a university, I remember, so you expected an intelligent answer from him. But he suggested the answer was camouflage. And Angela, with impressive politeness and self-restraint, responded, no, the answer is in fact distance. They live at opposite poles of the planet. And it's actually polar bears who blend into the background, not penguins.
And why don't polar bears eat penguins?
Because they can't remove the wrappers. Yeah, I know. That joke was old in 1978, so let alone 1988.
That joke was old when it appeared on penguin wrappers.
The Holy Grail is preserved in Westminster Abbey. True or false?
And as usual, thank you very much to Jake Collins for providing the voice of Dorcas.
Anybody who suggests true to that one should be shot.
Because there's something that archaeologists search for.
Creationist archaeologists, therefore not actually archaeologists. So anyway, they didn't say true, they said false, and that was correct.
Oh dear, truth will open, truth will out.
Now the drawbridge has turned into a door again. It's opened.
With two correct answers, Dorcas disappears to our considerable relief. And the drawbridge opens!
And the ceiling starts to fall.
Keep walking.
Quickly!
I keep looking at how far Nikki has walked across the drawbridge. By the time that ceiling has reached the height of her head, I genuinely don't think she gets there in time.
Talking about archaeologists, I've got this vision of her like just kind of jumping through the door in time and then having to reach out to grab the Helmet of Justice.
Ah, this must be the wood which Merlin spoke of. Pickle, this is more your sort of territory than mine. What do you know of this place?
Dunkley Wood. My people know it by another name, which roughly speaking translates as the old place. It's not a place we journey through, given choice. Apart from anything else, it's rumoured to be the haunt of assassins. There are standing stones here, if you can find them, but not, as I remember, much light. There is an elf path. There's always an elf path. But it won't be easy to find.
You may notice that this is actually the footage from the first couple of quests that was for the Dunwood, but this doesn't seem to matter particularly to anybody.
Pickle regurgitates the same speech as he's given to the other teams in the series who have made it this far. A patch of light appears on the footage, which Tregard claims is a guide.
The worst thing about this sequence, actually, is that in the end, it's just rather dull camcorder footage taken on an outing in the woods. It wasn't madly interesting to watch it the first time it was used, and this is, what, the third or fourth time? Go for a walk on another path in the same forest, even turn around and walk back along the same path so that you've got at least the background of it. Just do something different.
What I find interesting is that this patch of light appears. Usually that requires some kind of magic, which suggests to me that the change was actually made directly to the video footage.
Yeah, it could be. It's actually the same effect they used for the reflector in an earlier quest, isn't it? They might have actually taken a copy of the video footage and made alterations to that. I don't think they do it to the source footage.
George Lucas did it.
Well, yes, but he was actually trying to repair it. Although he did actually add a lot of crap to it.
There's a patch of light coming towards us.
I think that's a guy.
Follow the patch of light. Follow it. You're in the forest. You've come to a clearing, and in a tree there looks to be a kind of doorway.
I imagine a clearing with the entrance to Ariadne's lair in one of the tree trunks.
Which means something's going to happen.
With no other options, the team sidestep Nikki towards the doorway. Rather a lucky bit of guidance here. Nikki's route actually curls directly into the portal. Just before she reaches the portal, Ariadne looms into view from the opposite side of the screen.
Careful, the spider.
Keep going quickly.
And that adds a little bit of atmosphere, which is desperately needed by this point.
Always good to see Ariadne, in my opinion.
You're walking under a web, and near you there's a stump with some objects on.
But before we can learn what's on it...
Quick, Master, make them hurry up! She's just coming!
Quickly!
The Queen of the Earth!
Go back to us! Quick!
Quickly, sidestep!
Stand side to your left!
Which way?
Oh. And this is one of my favourite deaths in the show.
It is quite well done. I will give it. It is quite effective.
It's the sound effect. It's brilliant.
I'm not entirely sure what the crunching sound is supposed to be. Is it bones breaking or what is it? Gruesome is, I think, the word. And that's how a nightmare death should be.
I always assumed it was bones breaking.
I suppose it probably must be. The effects are good, and Ariadne is much, much scarier here because they just let the tape run at normal speed. So certainly nothing wrong with it as a death scene, but the problem with it is it does really highlight how unconvincing some of Ariadne's other scenes are in this season, when they have to keep pausing the tape or play it really slowly to give a dungeoneer who is not in losing status a chance to escape. It's always been a bit of a problem that Nightmare had, which was when a dungeoneer is not in losing status, everything becomes a little bit unrealistic insofar as it can be realistic when you're talking about a giant spider eating people wearing a medieval helmet. In isolation, it's a good bit of nightmare and redeems the episode a little bit.
And that is how Nikki met her rather crunchy end, the mandibles of the Queen of the Arachnids. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with this team. I think they are a victim of bad writing and bad pacing.
I agree with you. The quest itself is actually far, far worse than they are. And that can give the unfair impression that they're a really dull or witless side. They're no better than okay, but okay is better than that quest deserves. And I would say death at mid to late level 2, a bit flattering, but about right. About right.
They did need to listen to each other a bit more when answering riddles.
Yeah, but plenty of teams that have reached level 3 down the years, you could say that about. So that's the only flaw they've got. They're doing all right. There's nothing they're particularly good at, I think is the opposite side of the scale. There's nothing they're terrible at, but there's nothing they stand out. Their maneuvering is fine, but it doesn't have you thinking, wow, what a well-oiled machine that is. They get some riddles right, they get some riddles wrong. There are moments of indecision. They have moments when they're quite assertive. They're very much a middle-of-the-road team.
They got as far as they deserved, but they deserved a better quest at the same time.
Yeah, and I think they probably would have done better on a better written quest as well.
If only you'd gained some of Merlin's magic, then you could have made the spider hibernate. Now I'm afraid there's only one thing for it. Spellcasting. D-I-S-M-I-S-S.
Farewell, Karina, Emma, Catherine, and Nikki. St. Albans lies somewhere down the path behind you. But no webs to dodge this time.
Down to the grass by the castle, cause we died when our quest proved too much hassle. Oh, won't you please take me home?
Before we can mourn them too much, though, the next dungeoneer arrives and takes on the challenge.
Ah, well, there's another one on the doorstep. And not exactly a starving traveller by the look of him.
This hurts genuinely for me. Probably one of the lowest points.
One of the points that has become the most dated, I think, that immediately offsets any positivity you get from the death scene.
I don't blame anyone for this because it is a comment that is of its time, but looking back at it, it's disgusting.
If we're trying to be fair, you can suggest that it may have simply been a reference to height. He is a tall dungeoneer, as indeed are all of his advisors as well. It might have been a broad comment about the fact we've got some guys who are basically, they're on the other side of puberty, and it's pretty unusual to have contestants in Nightmare who've got to that point. They're all strapping fellows, and looking at the cod light of day, he isn't fat particularly. He's there's a very slight bulge. Does seem to lack a certain degree of suppleness, and that shows in some quite stiff maneuvering throughout the quest ahead, but it can be taken as a reference to his weight.
Yeah.
And that makes it careless at best. And that just shouldn't really happen at all. Having said that, we laugh anytime Traeguard says, oh, this one doesn't look promising at all, does it?
That's not a direct reference to a physical attribute.
I would agree.
Okay, we laugh when Brother Mace makes reference to his size, but that's him making reference to his size.
Yeah, it might just be it's a team of big lads. But the problem is you've left it open to the interpretation that it is to say, oh God, we've got a fat bloke on the front doorstep. That is careless and it should not have been done. Even with talking about this is the early 90s, even then I'd still say no, don't. You hear far, far worse things in episodes if they think it's all over.
Not usually aimed at children though.
Well, exactly. It's definitely not aimed at children.
Moving quickly on.
So, enter, stranger. Ah, and who makes this particular challenge?
Simon Haynes.
And I've been umming and ahhing about whether to leave this for the next episode or not, but I'm just going to say, this is that Simon.
Yeah, okay. We're definitely going to get at least one really classic moment from this quest to look forward to.
Sounds particularly elvish, Master.
Yes, we'd better have a look at his advisors quickly. Call them to us now.
Andrew, Richard, and Andrew.
Welcome.
We're introduced to advisors Andrew, Bev, Richard Condon, and Andrew Lloyd, who all hail from Swansea in Wales. Sorry. Look, I'm from Exeter. I'm only about 50 miles south of Swansea, so originally. So I think that's close enough for me to be allowed to say it. We used to be called West Wales down in the southwest a very, 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 very long time ago.
I actually love this short exchange.
Swansea? Pickle, don't your people come from somewhere around there?
No.
Ah, yes.
Just that's just so simple. No.
I've always hated that bit, actually.
Oh, really?
Sorry.
I was in hysterics.
David Lerner and Hugo Myatt knew each other quite well from working here on stage, so they had an ability to banter.
Yeah.
But I don't think they quite mastered the art of judging what's actually helpful and what isn't in the context of presenting Nightmare, and I just thought this is time-wasting. I can see what they're trying to do there.
Traeguard has checked that Simon has read the Avengers Code, reminds him briefly of the rules, gives him the knapsack and the helmet, and sends him through the dungeon door.
Turn then, face the dungeon door, and step boldly forward. Look, Master, look! It's the place of choice!
Quite so, quite so. Now listen, team. These are changing times, and the dungeons you must conquer are changing with them. The quest you choose here will select the path for you to follow. So choose now. The quest to redeem the cup that heals, or to find the sword of freedom.
Oh, the sword. Make them choose the sword.
I'm not going to make them choose anything, Biggle. The choice must be theirs. Now, quiet!
Well, hey, engineer, with the helmet on your head, would you go for the cup or the crown instead of the sword or the shield? Cause there's nothing in between. Oh, hey, adventure, don't be alarmed. But one false move can cause you harm. If you slip on the disc, you'll end up in a ravine. At the place of choice. At the place of choice. The place of choice. That place of choice.
It's not a promising start, by the way. The first time the team calls Simon's name, he doesn't even seem to hear them.
No, that's true. But the team moves Simon onto the turntable with little issue. This is the one good part of manoeuvring team do. They choose to take him on the quest for the sword and move him off the disc at the appropriate time. He does almost fall off the platform here, perhaps an omen for things to come. But he does regain his balance this time and continues forward.
To be fair, a lot of Dungeoneers are sort of tottering on the edge when they step off the spin dizzy onto one of the paths there, because it's a narrow path and you've got that sideways momentum. There's no reason to assume that Simon was particularly afflicted more than anybody else.
Okay, can you walk forward, please?
Where am I?
You're in by a castle. You're in the by the moat of a castle, and there's a drawbridge in front of you, but there's a looks like a massive gap about three spaces in front of you.
Why not just change the order in which the Dormunsters appear? Again, just to do something different. Anyway, the Dormunster appears, but before she can say anything...
Warning, Master. Phase shift about to occur.
Ah, yes, so it is. I'm sorry, boys. I'm afraid it's a case of time, gentlemen, please. There. They seem to have got the message.
Oh, not fair, Master. They'd only just started.
Quiet, Pickle. Things don't have to be fair. There's nothing about fair in the rules.
Well, who makes the rules, then?
Ah, sorry. I can't tell you that. Not in front of this lot. After all, it wouldn't be fair, would it?
And today's credit background is the transporter pad puzzle with the awesome painted waterfall at the back.
Oh, reminding us of better days even in season four. There were better days in season four. Indeed, there would be a couple of better days still to come. This was a load of crap. Do you want me to put a different word in there?
No, that's fine. No, it was a load of crap.
Yeah, there really is such a dearth of ideas at this point in the season that the quest wasn't just feeding off previous quests, it's even feeding off itself with more than one stock scene on level two. That is doubly concerning when you realise we are still an episode short of the halfway point of the season. So if they've already run out of ideas at this point, what the hell? With the game plan locations so limited and so narrow in their scope, what you need is a lively team that really gets into what they're doing, just to inject some energy and draw attention away from how badly the production is restricting itself. But instead, we got Nikki's team. And I say again, they're not bad, but compensating for the staleness of everything going on around them was just beyond them. They're just not loud or sort of invested enough to make this worth watching. The writer doesn't even change the order of locations, especially, which was something we saw happen all the time from quest to quest in earlier years. Pickle at the moment is still more trouble than he's worth in the Great Hall, largely just getting trade guards away. And there's some very silly set pieces with the actors, especially in the middle of level two, which end up playing a central role in advancing the gameplay and leaving the Dungeoneer as a spectator. Simon and Chums speak in a really stiff monotone, which means they're not really going to inject any more charisma or excitement than Nikki and her team are able to do. So there's little hope of this quest overall being more exciting because of the Dungeoneer and his advisors. Although we know we do have a really classic moment not that far into the future.
Classic for the wrong reasons.
We're left at this point in a most unpromising situation. This is not quite the worst episode of the season, but that says awful things in itself.
And again, I feel like I should emphasize, we are huge fans of this show. We wouldn't be doing this podcast if we weren't huge fans of the show. We have to be honest.
Yeah, as devotees of the show, we have a right to say when it was doing what we liked, but also when it stopped doing what we liked.
Well, yeah, anyone has the right for that. We would be doing the show and our listeners a disservice if we didn't give our honest opinions.
But anyway, that was season 4, episode 7, I'm afraid.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a rating and review on your platform of choice. It really helps us to grow our audience by reaching others who might be interested.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Nightmare Pod, although you might not want to at the moment because Twitter have just introduced that rather silly limiting rule.
Yes, I've got a bit of copy to read about it here.
Yep, absolutely.
The opposition over at the Tower of Twit have forced our hand by spellcasting rate limit, and as such, we over at Temporal Discussion, the Nightmare Podcast, have opted to set up a Mastodon account. This is because we feel like our reach is being limited too much by Twitter. We want to get out there. We want to get more people.
I think now that Twitter have done this, the Mastodon community is going to grow quite rapidly because I mean, everyone's getting absolutely fed up to the back teeth of Elon Musk doing things at random without thinking them through.
You can follow us over at topspicy.social/ at NightmarePod.
If you want to support the podcast, we're NightmarePod on Patreon.
Speaking of Patreon, here's a shout out to Keepers, the Book of Quest, David M. Rabbit, Paul McIntosh, Peter Polsford, and Scott Evans.
Advisors, Benjamin Bloom, David Thompson, and Peter Sidorn.
Not forgetting, of course, our newest advisors, who both joined us after this episode was recorded, Paul Craddy and Kim Harder. And that's a silly surname. And Dungeoneer Peter Corridge. Support us at Dungeoneer level or above to get your name mentioned on the podcast.
High-level perks also receive merchandise, have access to exclusive episodes, and if you pledge as a Keeper of the Book of Quests, we'll even offer you the chance to be a guest on the podcast.
Our website is nightmarepod.co.uk.
If you're looking for temporal discussion merchandise, including some rather dapper t-shirts and stickers and other products that make us look exceptionally sexy, it's at nightmarepod.redbubble.com.
You can email us at podcast@nightmarepod.co.uk.
And just keep telling yourself, it's only a podcast.
Isn't it?
Can't you see that, Your Highness? It's a bloody aardvark!